The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I'll offer you some of my reflections on pilgrimage. Since probably the time of the Buddha, it was a custom of those people who were serious about really engaging in meditation practice, which was the monastics, as there were no meditation centers and life was not set up so well for lay people to spend a lot of time meditating, that the monastics would alternate their year between being on the rains retreat, being on sedentary and meditating, and then traveling, going forth. And as the Buddha sometimes said, going forth for the welfare and happiness of all beings. And this rhythm of being traveling, with back then meant walking, and meditating, I think is a time-honored practice in Buddhism, that has a number of benefits going back and forth. And this custom of doing so, I've been told that in Korea, this at least in the 1980s when I was in that area, that Buddhist monastics would do two rains retreats a year. They would do two practice periods a year for 3 months. And the 3 months in between, they would empty the monasteries. And they'd go traveling around. And then after 3 months, they'd come back to a monastery and do another practice period. And so this alternation is a rhythm of going back and forth and doing this. And I'm a little bit fond of this instructions by the Tibetan teacher Chögyam Trungpa, who said that, if you can't meditate, travel. And I think for those who can meditate, it's meditate and travel. Meditate and head out. And there's something about a journey where in pilgrimage, where the purpose of it is not to get someplace, but the purpose is to be on the journey, to be on the walk, that on the bike ride, where there can be a connection to freedom, to being open to new experiences, to some of the qualities of the mind that are developed in meditation, being concentrated, being in the present moment, being open for new experiences, not being stuck in old ways. And if you're traveling in new places where people don't know you too much or at all, then it's also kind of freedom from our own persona. We don't necessarily have to live up to the same expectations that people have of us or the same personas we try to project or try to be. And we can be kind of fresh and new and light. I don't know if this probably wasn't wise, but I was only 17. When I was 17, I traveled around Europe by myself. And I was curious about this thing about identity and who I was and who I really am. So I just tried new identities. And I made up stories, biographies, tell people, you know, that I was, you know, just a whole new, you know, where I came from, what I was about. And I just made it up just to try it out. I figured it was safe enough. They would never see them again. And it wasn't to trick them into seeing me in different ways, but it was just to experiment with just being fresh and new and someone indifferent. And then when I was, that was when I was 18. And then when I was 19, I traveled to Morocco. And back then in Morocco, I don't know how it is now, the men wore something called a yalaba, I think it was called. And it's basically ankle length kind of a robe that they wear. And I started feeling, as I spent those weeks in Morocco, a very unusual feeling of lightness and ease in my mind that was kind of peculiar. And I thought, what is this? What is this? Why am I feeling this? And after a while, I recognized what was happening was I had no reference points for judging the men who wore robes, these kinds of robes. And they were so different than the kind of clothes people wore in the United States where I'd lived and in Europe where I'd lived. And And so that my automatic judgments that I had of people for about who they were because they wore a business suit or they were a jock or they were this and that, there were all kinds of judgments I had that were always a little operating, you know, in the background, maybe even unbeknownst to me, that affected my mind and the heaviness of mind or the contraction of mind. And going to a place where the culture was so different and my reference points weren't available to me, I just allowed those each person to kind of, I didn't have any judgments. I just, oh, look at this. And there was this lightness and ease that that came from this lack of being judgmental. So both the kind of freedom in being ourselves in a fresh way and the freedom of maybe allowing the people we encounter to be free of our associations, the reference points we usually have. And then there's the movement of a journey, of a pilgrimage. If it's walking classically or if it's biking in this modern world, that it kind of represents being unimpeded, just going and going. And if there are obstacles, to persevere through them, to keep going, just keep going, and adjusting according to what's needed and have the wisdom to know what right effort is. When to apply ourselves going uphill harder and when to stop making effort biking downhill and just coasting, how to prepare for a hill, how to manage with traffic and potholes and water on the road or whatever it might be. There's a lot of understanding what right effort is in biking. And so I understand that one of your themes for this year is the last three factors of the Eightfold Path. And the idea that in biking it becomes effortless, I hope, even though it might take a lot of energy, there's an effortlessness if someone is skilled in biking or skilled in hiking, in navigating all the subtle choices that are made in what is the right effort here? What is the right effort here? And the same thing happens in meditation practice, that we're constantly making, as we get skilled in it, and become as skilled in meditation as we become skilled in something like biking, it starts becoming effortless. There's an ease to it about how we adjust meditation depending on what's going on in our inner life or the world around us. And it takes a lot of mindfulness on a bicycle trip. And there's the motivation to be attentive biking, I think, is much higher for some people than it is while meditating, because the consequences of not being attentive is so strong, so big. And you can have an accident. You can go over a cliff. All kinds of things can happen. And this happened to one of your members many years ago, right? They went over the cliff. But it wasn't because they were inattentive, I don't think. But it requires attention. And that attention is meant to be done in conjunction with right effort. What is the right effort in being attentive? How do we pay attention? How do we be mindful in a way that's supportive, that's easeful, that's enjoyable, that's actually freeing? Is there freedom to be found in mindfulness itself? And I would say yes, absolutely. And sometimes a pilgrimage in this movement and into a new place and having to pay attention to where you put your feet or where you pedal and where you drive, that also can come with a very acute sense of clarity, really be there, and a feeling of freedom and delight and joy in doing it. And then the quality of concentration. I suspect that some people find it easier to get concentrated biking or walking than they do sitting in meditation. And it points to how something like a pilgrimage can support meditation, that, to go alternate between meditating and a pilgrimage or biking and sitting and biking, help support and develop this very important quality of concentration, stability to be. My favorite translation for the word samadhi is unification. And that's kind of one of the meanings of it, of the word samadhi, is to gather together things. And many of the synonyms for samadhi in Pali, the ancient language, that often get translated as concentration by the great translators, are actually words that mean to be composed or to be settled on something. And so settling together, gathering together, harmonizing, unifying. And I think that's one of the things that happens when we go on a walk, on a bicycle ride, and we stay in it and stay in the flow and just keep doing it, that after a while, everything, you know, is gathering together to just be right there for that activity. And hopefully some of the ordinary concerns and worries of life, and also some of the conceits and self kind of preoccupations that we might have in ordinary life, begin to fall away and become thinner and weaker in this full engagement, something that really fully engages us in what we do. The Buddha talked about doing pilgrimages, visits to the four sacred sites of his life. So people go to commemorate that or remember that. But he also talked about there were three places that every practitioner should remember. So this is kind of like, where do you make your own personal pilgrimage? And he said there's three places. One is the place where you went for refuge. The place where you really kind of something happened to you, where you finally recognized, you know, this. I go for refuge. I'm orienting my life. I'm basing my life on Buddhism, and that's considered a momentous occasion, even though it might not feel as momentous to oneself at the time. But to really fully said, oh, okay, this is really works for me. This Buddha Dharma Sangha, what it represents for me. This is what I want to base my life in. This is a mirror for what I'm discovering in my own practice that I really want to make my life, to have some sense of freedom, sense of inner goodness, some sense of inner purity or wisdom or something that, okay, now I know, and this is what I take refuge in, what I orient myself around. So the place where that happens. He also said, for those people who are stream mentors, the place where one becomes a stream mentor. And for someone who becomes a fully awakened arhat, the place where they became fully awakened. So for a practitioner then, their own place where significant stages of their practice occur are considered important to remember and to, he doesn't say go back and visit them, but to remember. And how I interpret this is that, and I apply this now, is that the sacred, if a pilgrimage means to go to someplace sacred in conventional English, the sacred place we're going is in ourselves. That we can find in ourselves the pilgrimage spot by our practice, by engaging in practice and connecting as we do something with our own capacity for inner freedom and compassion and love and wisdom. And so for you all to go on a pilgrimage and with this current era of smoke and COVID and everything, maybe some of you will do it in an unconventional way today, not just on a bike. But for you to go out on a pilgrimage now, And what would it be like to call it a pilgrimage that is a pilgrimage to yourself, a pilgrimage to really discover or touch into or awaken or evoke something deep that you know from your practice or that you know that existentially is really, you know, core to how you want to live and what's most valuable for you. And to make that kind of the theme, the purpose of doing something that's called a pilgrimage, that it's in yourself. And even though you might go someplace from one place to another, it's really the place you're hopefully coming to is in some renewed, deeper connection to yourself that is really free. In a sense, becomes free of self, has a vast, boundless freedom, and that the pilgrimage, the full engagement, the involvement, the movement, and classically being in the open air and open to new experiences and new discoveries and being attentive and having the effort to just really give yourself over to it fully, have the awareness to really see everything as fresh and new, to really kind of get focused and unified in this experience of pilgrimage is partly a pilgrimage to oneself. And some people would say to finally arrive here in the sacred site in your own heart. So that would be a pilgrimage. And I think that this bicycle pilgrimage that's been going on for many years now is kind of a pioneer effort for making sacred California for us Buddhists. That as you bring yourself, your practice, and your freedom and your refuge on this bicycle trip to the various places that you've gone over the years and will continue to go over the years, that you're creating a tradition here of something that I think is extremely important for us Buddhists to be engaged in and be part of. And the fact that this year, I think, that the pilgrimage, a little bit I picked up because of, you know, the smoke and different things. Some of you are going to do it in non-bicycle ways. And I think maybe this is fantastic. Maybe this is a new era that I always do bicycle trips. But maybe now it can expand and include all kinds of other ways in which people can do pilgrimages and learn the freedom and the goodness. And finally, I was asked to do a blessing for you as you start off on your pilgrimage to yourself. And I hope that the 2,500 years of practitioners heading out on their walk, on their pilgrimage, on their yantra, on their going forth out into the world, that all of their freedom, all of their compassion, all of their goodness with which they headed out, is you're standing on the shoulder of that. You're following in the momentum of that. You're not doing this alone. You are doing this as a continuation of a 2,500-year tradition. And so may you kind of be carried by the momentum of all these hundreds of years so that you're inspired to awaken your heart, awaken your mind, to discover what the very best qualities that exist inside of yourself in the pilgrimage, in the biking, in the walking, whatever you're going to do today. And may that be for the welfare and the happiness of beings everywhere. May it be that you are becoming free so that the people you meet you can touch with your care, your love, your compassion, and your freedom. May your pilgrimage be for the welfare and happiness of this whole world. Thank you very, very much. And I'm very happy you're doing this, and I do feel you're doing this for all of us. It's a very important kind of practice you're doing that I'm hoping will spread and become replicated and a regular part of our Buddhist scene in California. Thank you. Happy travels.